No, thank you, she said brightly. I'm not at all hungry.
He stared at her, colouring slowly. He seemed inclined to strike her, then turned abruptly and left her alone at the window. She heard him banging drawers in the desk, collecting his coat and hat from the peg, slamming the door behind him. She turned from the window and went to stub out her cigarette. The small painting of Hampstead Heath hung in the grey light in its golden frame. She let her hand linger for a moment on the cold blue glass of Tom's ashtray. She turned it on its axis twice, three times, then left it where it was.
I miss you,
she said to the empty office. January 1941. They called the new club the Joint, as if it weren't a thing in itself, but only a hinge between night and day. The bombers raised their tempo, and the syncopated city matched the rhythm. When a raid interrupted the minstrel show now, the players rushed underground with the audience to join the big band that was already down there. They had cleared out the Lyceum's great basement to make the club. There was a stage at one end, a bar at the other, and alcoves in between where soldiers pushed their luck. Zachary fetched drinks from the bar in exchange for coins and cigarettes. It was weeks since he'd last seen the sky. It suited him. If you couldn't see the sky, he couldn't see you. People patted him on the head when he fetched their drinks. They called him Baby Grand. Everyone was christened again now, sometimes two or three times, as if by this expedient every person might stay ahead of the war's ability to call them by name. No one cared if he drank, so he did. He slept under the bar and smoked like Betty Davis. He ate cocktail nuts, the glacé cherries from the bottoms of glasses, whatever he could get. Everyone was hungry. The new pianist discovered that if he waited a quaver after the beat, and then hit down hard to give some heavy swing, then factory girls and airmen on leave could be made to dance even if they were weak from the rations. Laying down drinks on the tables, Zachary picked up the gossip. Apparently so many souls were being lost every night that in the great mortuaries of Clerkenwell and Cheapside, a dozen families would now claim any unrecognisable corpse as their cousin or mother or aunt. So now the morgue staff stripped the remains, tagged clothing and flesh with the same number, and had families identify the effects instead of the bodies. Zachary hadn't been asked to identify a thing, not a tie clip or a ring. He wondered if his father was in some grave, being mourned under a new name. He prayed for him under the old one. They said that above ground now, when only human fragments were recovered, the city assessed by weight how many bodies should be assembled. And if a few of the reincorporated dead had more than one left leg, then at least none of the coffins felt light. The drinkers caught him eavesdropping, and they laughed and said, "What do you think of that, Baby Grant?" He said, "It sounds fair." But he thought of his father, who had so carefully washed off his white face at the end of every performance, hashed together with white bodies. Zachary drank what was left in the glasses, and the big band played for 45 minutes in each hour, all night, and whereas in peacetime the horns and the piano always used to play around each other in fast eddies, it was now discovered that if they all united instead in big block chords, then at 3 a.m. and 4 a.m, with the air rayed hot and heavy overhead and the dance floor jumping on its joists and dust pouring from the vaulted roof of the basement, then the slim negro band leader, with his shirt soaked in sweat, could lean into his streamlined microphone as if into a great headwind and call at the crowded white dancers. "Check down at your feet, good ladies and gentlemen, for so long as you are still dancing, you cannot yet be dead." And Zachary bussed tables, and the orchestrated city tapped its great stock of shrouds and cardboard caskets, releasing a precise number each night in expectation of casualties, predicted from cloud cover and bomber concentrations. And according to the gossip, if a piece of a Londoner could be collected with dustpan and brush, then it would be sent downstream on the barges with the rest of the city's refuse to the great municipal middens at Durham Wharf, while all larger bodily phrases were composed into persons nameable and taken for classical burial. And the cavernous basement boomed. You were safe if dancing or dead. London remembered its oldest rhythm of putting the saints beneath it, and in the public cemeteries of Highgate and Nunhead and Kensal Green, the old graves were dug up and the crotchety bones scattered to make room for new. The enemy enlarged its bombs from 500 kilograms to 1,000 and 2,000, and down in the basement the band leaders put together two bands and three bands, so that six coloured men, and now nine coloured men, all swung in line in the horn section, and two Negro drummers, and now three Negro drummers, sweated at their kits on the big raised dais at the back of the stage. And Zachary remembered how his father had used his heavy left hand to stamp out the colossal chords. Boom, 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 and the limitless suburban cemeteries opened up fresh ground, and the commuter trains in the middle of the day took the coffins out into Metroland and returned with a toot on the whistle and the conductor's call of empties. And all the murderous night the big band drummers smashed out time while the stonemasons in their massed choir with their steel chisels in perfect orchestration tapped out the assumed names of the dead in letters Zachary couldn't read. How unbearable it was that his father's name was lost. How thin his own limbs seemed. He heard the music, and he heard the news from above, and it seemed to him now that the world above and the world below were playing the exact same tune. Every morning, when the club kicked out and the band put their horns back into velvet, he swept and put the stools up. The dawn left him deaf from the silence. No one had talk in them. Under the electric bulbs, he ate with the band and the barmen, and then all of them went where they would, and Zachary curled up in his place under the bar where no one minded him. If he woke before the crowd came back, if the stools were still up and the bombers far away, then he went to the piano. He played the quiet pieces the way his father had shown him, eyes closed, softly. He did what he could. His father hadn't wanted him to be in the show, and he wasn't. And yet there was this agony. He played the slow tunes, and sometimes he almost had his father with him for an hour, and then the crowd flooded back, and he smiled and fetched drinks for them. When he played his father's music, he was almost back home. But a tune had no fixed place in time. It was a city before the eternal. It was only ever a joint.
January 1941. Mary sat with her mother, and they read the morning's post while they waited for lunch. The manager at the Lyceum had replied. Zachary was in good health and being provided for, and Mary wasn't to concern herself. She frowned and folded the letter back into its envelope.
"What is it?"
said her mother.
"Just Hilda," said Mary. "The men she favours, the shops she doesn't. How dreary. But it's Hilda, so she makes it fun, of course."
Then why the long face?
I worry for her. I wish she could meet someone nice.
Well, click your heels together three times when you wish.
Mary wondered if the manager had meant it kindly when he wrote that she wasn't to concern herself. There would be a natural wariness, she supposed, of whites. Perhaps she hadn't made it clear in her own letter that she was one of the helpful kind. Palmer's footsteps were so delicate as to be barely audible when he brought lunch in at one. Cook had set a mixed shoal of shrimp and whitebait into clear aspic, using a mould in the form of a wave. The wave was encircled on its salver by a salad of fruits de mer, the whole resting on a bed of toasted golden seeds that made convincing sand. Mary's mother put on her spectacles to examine the production, then had Palmer hold it up to the window so that daylight shone through the wave.
"And the beauty is that none of it is on the ration. People make such a fuss about the hardships, but one need only be inventive. What do you think, my dear?"
"I'm astonished the poor haven't thought of it," said Mary.
Her mother ignored her.
"Of course, it's only a practice for the real thing."
For a moment, before she understood that the dish was a prototype for the fully operational version of itself, Mary couldn't think what her mother meant. She stared at the tiny creatures as they flashed in the afternoon light, and wondered what could be the real-life experience for which this was preparation. Drowning, perhaps, quite close to the beach, in a well-stocked corner of the ocean? She had stopped paying attention to the tireless campaign of dinners and cocktails through which her mother hoped to fight father into cabinet.
"Are you quite with us?" said her mother.
"Sorry," said Mary. "I hardly slept. Oh, who does? But you might at least have an opinion.
Mary squinted into the wave.
The shrimps are rather sweet. Look at their little faces. But, darling, don't you notice something?
Mary noticed that Palmer was trembling with the strain of holding up the salver to the light. The vibration caused a pulsation in the wave, as if it might crest at any moment and break into streaks of mannered foam.
I think Cook has dyed the aspic, hasn't he? It's a very subtle green.
Her mother made an exasperated sound.
Yes, but the shrimp. Don't you see? Half of them are swimming upside down.
And they would hardly be scattered throughout the wave like that, willy-nilly.
Shrimp would be down near the seabed, feeding.
It's almost as if Cook has forgotten her marine biology.
Well, you mock me, but this is why we have a practice run. Oh, Palmer, you may put the damn thing down now, and let's see how it slices.
While Palmer set to with a serving knife, Mary's mother briefed her on the next evening's table plan.
Father will be here on the left, giving the minister the head of the table. Anderson will sit here with you on his right to make him laugh, which you are awfully good at, and you must try to show off your figure a little. You have worn nothing but sackcloth since... well, since you know when.
I'm not entirely clear on my role. Am I to seduce Anderson, or to render him well-disposed towards Father?
Would a little of both be beyond you?
Anyway, you mustn't look at me like that. I have invited Henry Hunter Hall just for you, and he will be sitting here, directly opposite. You may bother each other with your toes, or whatever it is that young people do since the art of conversation was lost.
It is too soon.
I was in love with Tom. I think you know that I was.
Dear, you are 20 years old. We all have our practice runs.
You're relieved that Tom died.
Oh, not at all. I'm dreadfully sorry when anyone is killed, doubly so if it is someone you were fond of.
Mary smiled.
What?
Said her mother.
Well, you make him sound like a pony or a Labrador.
It's only that he was never someone I thought of as a grown-up match for you.
He was killed trying to save one of my pupils.
I thought it grown-up. It is heartbreaking, I know, but one advances through such trials.
And hence Henry, to be seated opposite me, and in whom, with your blessing, I am to find consolation. Tell me, should I write out the place cards in Tom's blood, or would you prefer me to use my own?
Must you be like that? I'm only anxious that you should get straight back on with life. Henry's a likeable boy, from a very good family, and you shan't tell me he isn't handsome.
There was a sadness in her mother's eyes. Mary wondered whether it had always been there, becoming visible only now that she had attuned to sorrow's frequency.
Mother, she said, were you ever in love with Father?
Her mother looked towards the salver where Palmer, before dematerializing, had carved the pristine wave into slices.
We were very lucky to find each other,
she said.
Yes, but were you?
Yes, we were very lucky.
Sometimes, Mother, I don't know whether you'd be glad if I went along with you and attended your functions and married some outrageously suitable Henry, or whether you wouldn't secretly be much happier if I just said, hang it all, and flew as close to the sun as I jolly well dared.
Yes, you are quite right. You don't know that.
A grey wind blew snowflakes past the windows. When the silence got too much, Mary said,
Hilda thinks we should volunteer for the ambulances.
Hilda is jolly public-spirited.
You know as well as I do that she only covets the uniform.
I'm glad it's you who said it.
So, do you think we should?
Should what?
Join the ambulances.
Her mother fetched the cigarette case from its place on the mantel. She took a cigarette and slid the case over to Mary. Palmer appeared and disappeared, in such a way that he left behind him 2 lit cigarettes, an onyx ashtray, and no lingering image on the back of the eye. It was the first time Mary had smoked with her mother. They said nothing. They tended their cigarettes, while the sliced aspic, untouched, melted slowly in the heat of the dining-room fire, releasing fish and shrimp by ones and twos into an uncertain future.
January 1941. Alistair guessed that the arithmetic might not be encouraging if worked through to its conclusion. Malta was 8 miles wide by 18 long, as large as London, only with less to do in the evening. From this unpromising rock, their best remaining possession of the Mediterranean, the starving garrison had orders to hold out against the combined forces of Germany and Italy. Alistair tried to count the enemy's available armies, but he ran out of fingers.
"Heath?" said Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton.
"My apologies, sir. I was miles away."
"I bet you wish you were."
Alistair grinned.
"Sir. Brief the men, will you? A pep talk would be nice. Otherwise, any kind of talk they will listen to. Soliloquy, philippic."
He waved his hand as if it was all too wearisome. Alistair saluted and left the old man to his paperwork. 10th Regiment Royal Artillery was mustered at easy readiness among the ramparts of Fort St. Elmo. The men relaxed in the twilight and lounged against the stone walls, while below them Grand Harbour shone under a fulvous moon. The men had the news already. The carrier Illustrious had been badly smashed up and was on its way into port. Now the whole spite of the enemy would be directed against the island to finish the great ship off. It was up to Alistair to tell the men, officially, that they were in for it. He swallowed his nerves, blew his tin whistle, and stood firm while 200 men came to their feet with the grudging compliance they might have afforded to a football referee who could just as usefully have let play continue. The men got themselves into their 3 batteries, each battery subdivided into 2 troops of 4 guns apiece, each gun accounting for a sergeant and 7 gunners. They lined up, facing Alistair, while the senior officers assembled at his side, his 5 fellow captains and the 3 majors. As captain, Alistair commanded a 4-gun troop. Even when one added his 2 subalterns and his warrant officer, only 35 of the men arranged before him were his own. It was nerve-wracking, which was why Hamilton did it, made his juniors take turns to address the whole of 10th Regiment. The men fell quiet, waiting for Alistair to be a genius. They watched him with a world-class loyalty and affection that only the British Army could disguise as open sarcasm. At his side, Simonson whispered,
"Your flies are undone, old man."
With effort, Alistair stopped himself from checking. Simon whispered,
"Oh, and your mother telephoned."
Alistair ignored him.
"I'm to let you know that your father's cock tastes of your dog's arse."
To stop himself laughing, Alistair had to bite his cheek. He took a step forward.
"Well, men, as you all know, our loved ones are taking a beating back home, and they are holding us superbly, and now it is our turn. The Admiralty tells us that one of their tubs, Illustrious, has undergone some unplanned modifications at sea. She's on her way in now, and we can be certain that the enemy will spare no effort to sink her in port."
"Or brandy," whispered Simonson.
"Perhaps we cannot do much against high-altitude bombing, but as you know, we have a very effective anti-aircraft weapon in the 3.7-inch gun, and we intend by coordinated firing to establish a box within which the enemy's dive bombers cannot operate."
"A lunchbox," whispered Simonson. "A cricket box."
"Gunners, your sergeants will be issued with the angular sectors and elevations for each gun. There will be a coordinated firing sequence in order to achieve the maximum coverage of shell splinters for the minimum expenditure of ordnance. The details will be..."
As Alistair spoke, he had noticed a growing agitation among the men. Now they were looking past him, over the ramparts. Alistair stopped talking and turned to see what they were watching. Looming huge over the breakwaters, Illustrious was limping into Grand Harbour under cover of dark. Alistair had never seen a carrier, and he was awed at the size of her. She wore no lights, and the harbour was blacked out, but they could see her silhouette against the moonlight. She darkened half the sky. Her huge turbines throbbed as she ghosted in. The sea breeze brought the awful smell of her, scorched metal and flesh, burned aviation spirit, leaking oil. No one spoke. 12 officers and 200 men watched for 2 full minutes in silence. When the smell got too much, Alistair turned back to the men.
"All right," he told them, abandoning the speech he had planned. "As you can see, she will be hard to miss, even for the Italians. We had better all get to our guns."
Back with his own troop, Alistair felt all right. He busied himself with making each man as comfortable as he could. Since it would be a cold night, he had blankets and bedding brought up from below, and thermoses filled with cocoa. He sent his subaltern to the medical officer to secure a stock of eye drops and benzedrine for the men, knowing from his experience in France that it would be two or three more days at full alert before the stuff was needed, but that by the time it was, it would be gone. He split each gun crew into two watches of 2 hours, and he spent the long night walking the quarter-mile beat of his guns. No attacks came. Finally, with the hum of fatigue in his ears as the day dawned in grey cloud, he took himself down to the rocks below the fort. He looked at the sea and thought about Tom. The waves broke themselves on the rocks, each retreating with its wounded hiss to succumb to the surge of the next. They came from the horizon to do it. Alistair watched the incoming queue of them. Not one wave jumped its order or renounced its destination. Death, finally, was British. Life chaotic and foreign. The cloud clung to the island all morning, and at noon the lieutenant colonel had them stand the gun crews down. A long lull began. The cloud stayed so low that nothing could fly, and with so much of the Royal Navy still in the approaches, the enemy would risk nothing from the sea. All eyes peered upwards. At any perceived darkening of the grey, the men would remark that it was turning out nice again. Any slight break in the cloud brought anxious silence. In short order, the men became authorities on grey, able to distinguish between the nuances of ash, dusk, and silver, granite, slate, and mouse. Their upturned faces took on the life-saving pallor. Leave was cancelled, officers and men confined to the fort. There were no more afternoons sailing or swimming. On the first day, fresh barrels were fitted to the guns. Shells were brought out and inventoried and restocked into the underground magazines. When there was nothing more that could usefully be made ready, the men were given 100 things to polish, the rubble-painted gun carriages, the brass oil lines, the optics of the predictor gear. When all the artillery pieces gleamed, the men moved on to cutlery, flagpoles, boots. By the end of the second day of the lull, the fort and all its contents were burnished to a furious sheen. When there was nothing left to shine, there were walls of sandbags to be moved. It was discovered by the officers of the regiment, with their 3 batteries in 8-hour rotation, that if the men of the first battery moved a sandbag wall from A to B, the second from B to A, and the third from A to B again, then the first battery would come back on duty satisfied that their work was still as they had left it. By the third day of the lull, even the most imaginative officers could no longer busy their men. Now the grey of the sky began to bleed into the soldiers' unguarded hearts. Men stared at the featureless clouds and saw enemy planes where there were none. There were false alarms and loud panics. Memory was blinded, and none could remember a time when they had not stood guard on the timeless ramparts. On their mean rations, an ancient hunger slowed their minds. The ghosts in the old stone haunted them. Officers brooded and traced their fingers over the scratched graffiti of past garrisons. Men off duty woke screaming in the night, babbling that the Turks had breached the walls. A bloodied axe was found on the ground in the central courtyard, with tufts of blonde hair still clinging to the blade. Some supposed the hair to be human, others thought it was goat. When a roll call was taken, one of each was found to be missing. On the fourth day, all was quiet. The missing man was found in a village inland, injured only by drink. Alistair tried to remember Tom's face. Already he could hardly remember it differently from Duggan's. He couldn't catch a glimpse of their old life together through the low, grey ceiling of memory. Instead, he saw Mary, her copper hair, her insubordinate grin, and he was sick at himself. He lay in his cot, staring at his grey metal table with its lit candle. Its small flame, through Tom's blackberry jam, cast a bloody glow across the writing paper. At dawn, on the fifth day, he went up to take the report of the off-going watch. He smoked his pipe while he looked out over the sea. The breeze was fresh on his face. He watched the red sun edge up into a vast pink sky, but it was a long time before he understood that the cloud was gone. He creased his eyes against the light. Already the horizon was starting to blue. It was a perfect bomber's sky. He tapped out his pipe on the stone, ran his fingers through his hair, and felt the familiar battle lurch in his stomach. It was 6, and the fresh watch was coming up from the fort. He hurried to get them installed, but they were not even halfway ready before the fort's electric bells started up. A minute later, as men rushed to their stations and the fort erupted into action, the sirens began to wail across Valletta and all around the harbour. The Germans attacked, so much harder than the Italians. The Germans were inflexible in their fury, deploying it in a pre-arranged configuration. For the next week, there was not 1 hour when an attack did not come from their dive bombers or their high-altitude rigs. When it finally ended on the 8th night, the men who had not been pierced by shrapnel or mutilated by their own guns' recoil were so deafened by 1 million bangs that their ears bled through the yellow dust that clogged them. They were so washed through with amphetamines and smoke that they saw visions as they collapsed, officers and men alike, into piles around their guns. Like children kept awake beyond endurance, they slept where they fell, mouths agape, faces as still as death. All night the fine yellow dust, which had risen a mile high in the bombing, drifted down on the men in a shroud. When Alistair woke, the only sound was the keening of seagulls. He rubbed dust out of his eyes until he could see. Under a sky that was finally grey again, the harbour was black with oil and foul with sewage. Every pipe in the port must have cracked. The air could have stripped paint from the inside of a man's chest. He stumbled up the stone stairs to the signals room, but when he picked up the field telephone, the line was dead. After 8 days and nights of dive bombing, nothing was connected to anything anymore. The garrison was a join-the-dots puzzle, and Alistair was not sure he wanted to know what it looked like when it was completed. He was the only soul awake. He roused his subaltern. If he had had to shake him any harder, Alistair would have been doing the enemy's work. He held the man by his shoulders, gave him a stern look, and said, "Coffee." Briggs looked back at him from a distance measured in miles. "Coffee," said Alistair again. "Co-fee."
"Yes, please."
"No, Briggs, you make coffee. For officers." His subaltern gave a clumsy salute and stumbled off to bang pots. Alistair went along the guns until he found Simonson. He shook him awake.
"What is it, you contemptible man?"
"I came to see if you were alive."
"Well, I'm not, so clear off."
Alistair said, "I thought you might want to know that the war is over." Simonson sat up in the dust and blinked twice.
"God, Jesus, really?"
"Yes," said Alistair. "Telegram just in from London. Immediate cessation of hostilities. Troop ships home for us within the week." Simonson closed his eyes and gave an ecstatic sigh.
"Oh, thank Christ."
Alistair gave him 20 seconds and then said,
"No, not really."
Simonson opened one bloodshot eye.
"You vile, vile bastard."
"Returning the favour for your help with my speech last week. Coffee?"
"I hope it poisons you."
"My man Briggs is brewing some. Come over to my room, and then we must rouse the men and get ourselves operational again."
Simonson eyed the clouds.
"The Germans won't come today."
"They won't need to if we let this rot set in. Everyone's still snoring."
Simonson pulled his jacket over his head.
"It worked for the French."
Alistair laughed.
"I thought you wanted to make major."
"Yes, so oiks like you can do the drudgery."
"Did I mention," said Alistair, "that our friendship means the world to me?"
Simonson only groaned.
"But it does, you know. I'm mildly glad every time you're not killed."
Simonson opened half an eye and leered at him.
"At last. Meet me in the showers at midnight, and for God's sake not a word to Matron."
For the rest of the day, the two captains saw to the men of their battery. There were the injured to be evacuated to the hospitals further inland, the badly battle-frayed to be rotated out for R&R, and the battery's 8 guns to be consolidated down to 6 fully manned units. Everything needed repairing, cleaning and oiling. Each of the 3.7s needed re-levelling on its jacks. Every site wanted recalibrating, and every signal line had to be taken up, checked for breaks, and relayed.
Inside, in the labyrinthine fort, everything had been shaken from its shelf, or taken to the wrong place in the chaos, or stolen, or eaten, or sublimated. It was a mercy that every unit of the British Army came so fully documented that it could be reassembled from its constituent parts by men who had hardly slept. Alistair and Simonson worked their battery back up to readiness using their technical manuals and the quartermaster's equipment list. If they had happened to pick up the wrong instructions at the beginning of the day, it seemed to Alistair that they might just as easily have ended up with the bus company or a small dairy farm. At nightfall, there was still so much fuel oil in the sea that Alistair half expected the setting sun to ignite it. He was too tired to think straight. He stumbled up the stone staircase to his room and sat down on his cot. Airmail had come during the day. A Wellington had slipped in through the lull in the enemy's air cover, and a letter was waiting for him on his desk. He slit the envelope open, not recognising the hand.
"Alistair, I hope you shan't mind if I write. You must feel as rotten as I do without Tom. I was going through his things when I found a letter you wrote to him, asking forgiveness for the night you and I met. I do not know whether he managed to reply. I thought it might do you good to know that Tom often spoke of you. He looked up to you. He was never reconciled to staying in London while you put your neck on the line. So if Tom seemed distant in his letters towards the end, you mustn't think that he meant to be. Some days he could seem 1,000 miles from me, even though we would be sitting at the same table. Everyone is tired here, after so many months of bombing. There is a distance between all of us now. I do not mean to be maudlin, only to tell you how it is in London. After the war, of course, it will be like the start of spring, which is always so brilliantly sudden. The leaves will burst back onto the trees and close the gaps between the branches, and we shall be startled, shan't we, as we are startled at the end of every winter. We shall think, oh, I had quite forgotten there were 3 livable seasons. Tom wouldn't want us to be sad. I took crocuses to his grave this morning. I arranged them as best I could, and then I came home. On the way home, the train was crowded. I was hungry. There was a man in my compartment with an irritating laugh. One does not rise above the everyday simply because one ought to. In the end, I suppose we lay flowers on a grave because we cannot lay ourselves on it. Hilda and I have applied to work on the ambulances. It might be exciting to drive an ambulance, although to listen to my father, my driving would be certain to cause further casualties. In any case, they will not let me teach. It is too bad, but perhaps they are right. It is my constant regret that my class would still be alive if I had not insisted on carrying on once the air raids began. We live, you see, and even a mule like me must learn. I was brought up to believe that everyone brave is forgiven, that in wartime courage is cheap and clemency out of season. Unless you tell me otherwise, I shall keep up the rent on the garret. I thought you might like it to be there when you got back. In your wardrobe you have 3 viable ties, 4 shirts, of which 2 are almost serviceable, and a lounge suit in a style that I can only describe as conventional. Forgive me if you feel that dull is a better word. I have applied mothballs. I was tempted to use something more flammable. You must let me know what you want to do about arrangements. Sincerely, Mary North. Alistair put down the letter and stood up. For a few minutes, he looked out over the devastated port and the black harbour sickly with oil. Then he sat back at his metal table and took up a stub of pencil and an aerogram sheet.
Dear Mary, thank you for your kind letter. You must surrender the garret and let me know what you have paid in rent so I can reimburse you. As for my poor old clothes, surely there is some yokel in your father's constituency who can hang them on a scarecrow. Furthermore, he hesitated. What had she meant by, you must let me know what you want to do about arrangements?
He read her letter through again, finding it impenetrable. If it was a simple request for instructions, perhaps there were too many crocuses in it. If it was something more, then perhaps there were not enough roses. He screwed up his page and began again.
Mary, if you really do not mind, I hope you will keep the garret on, at least until I have a chance to come and say goodbye to the old dump. I would like a place to remember Tom by. Of course it is your place now, yours and his, so you must do what you feel is... He crumpled that page up too.
Was she asking him to talk about Tom, or allowing him not to?
She missed Tom, he missed Tom, but the living must live with the living. This was understood in her letter. Therefore, how boorish of him to bang on about Tom.
He rubbed his eyes. It was impossible. In the history of the world, there was not one example of a man ever having written a satisfactory letter to a woman who mattered to him. How could he even attempt it, after 8 days and nights of bombing? And yet this is when he must write, now, in the lull between attacks, when his letter would go straight out on the next available aeroplane. War made one do everything when one wasn't at all ready. Dying, yes, but also living.
Mary? Damn the garret, and damn my old clothes. I wish I were there with you. He stopped. Perhaps he was entirely misreading it. Now that he read her letter again, he was ashamed. She loved Tom, and Tom was dead, and her letter was a game attempt to buck herself up. She was a child talking herself into courage, and she wanted a brotherly word from him, nothing more. She needed him to tell her that it was all right, that he felt hollow about Tom too, that this was simply how it was with the dead, and it did not mean that one had not loved them enough. And yet at the same time, her letter seemed to say, "I love you. Can anything be done?" After only the mildest decryption. He put his head in his hands and groaned. She had had this effect on Tom too, of course, had driven his poor friend around the twist, wondering if it could possibly be true that she liked him. If Alistair could believe that he felt Tom laughing at him from beyond the grave, it might make everything easier. But the truth, of course, was just as Mary had put it. One felt nothing at all from the dead. They died, and then they were gone, and one's heart ached from the sudden absence of feeling more than from any surfeit. He held Mary's letter and breathed in the smell of it, soap and cigarette smoke. Here it was, in his hands, this hour of her life in London that he supposed had not been straightforward. He picked up his pencil and began again. "Mary, I do not mind what you do with the garret. I mind if you are happy. Do not keep the garret on my account. Keep it if you feel better there. Please consider not taking the ambulance driver position. You know that it is dangerous work in a raid, and you have lost quite enough already. What I find with my men is that they will rush into harm's way after they have lost a friend. Partly it is the desire to avenge, but it is more than that. I tell them that the war is not their fault. I give my men permission to feel guilty if they die themselves, and not before. Do not let them tell you that you cannot teach any more. If you are good at it, then teach. Find a way. And do not think you are one to follow orders. We are all of us orphaned by this war. The world that bore us is gone, and now we must be useful where we can. Yours, Alistair." He folded the aerogram, addressed it, gave it to Briggs, and collapsed back onto the cot. His letter flew off the island on the same Wellington that had brought Mary's. The aeroplane also carried a burned RAF man, bound for home via Gibraltar. The casualty lay on a carpet of mail bags in the narrow tunnel of the tail section that ended in the rear gunner's turret. The pilot kept the Wellington at 60 feet until they were out of range of Axis fighters operating from Sicily, and then he climbed and began to thread a high line between Sardinia and the Barbary coast. 60 miles north of Tunis, the burned airman died of his wounds. It happened quietly in the drone of engine noise, and in the last minutes the numbing cold of high altitude was a comfort to the man. There, in the sweet sacking smell of the mailbags, he understood that he was dying, and it pleased him that he was going in the company of so many soft words home. He looked down through the perspex side panel of the Wellington and watched the endless blue Mediterranean wash the blood away from all shores. The crew of the Wellington experienced no mechanical problems and encountered no enemy aircraft.
Leaving Algiers to port, the pilot turned across open water to Gibraltar. There was cloud in the western Mediterranean, and as they closed onto the Spanish coast, it came lower. By the time the pilot made radio contact with the tower at Gibraltar, he had been forced down below 1,000 feet, and a southerly wind was buffeting the Wellington from side to side. The tower had the pilot make a west-to-east landing from the Atlantic side. As they came in behind the rock, the crosswind kicked up a sudden gust and yawed the plane just as its landing gear touched down. The Wellington lifted one wing, dug the other wingtip into the deck, and spun sideways off the end of the runway into the sea. In the cold water off Gibraltar, Alistair's letter sank to 300 feet along with 1,100 other letters, the burned airman and the six-man aircrew, and none of them ever made it home. February 1941. A month went by with no reply from Alistair. When a letter came accepting her for a post as an ambulance driver, Mary smoothed it out on the writing table of her bedroom at her parents' house. She frowned at it, holding her cigarette any old way, not caring if it stained her fingers. Smoke had gone over to the enemy's side in any case. It had once been the same stuff that curled from a genie's lamp. Now it only reminded one. What ought she to do? Perhaps she should give in and let her mother marry her off. Or she could join the ambulances and see what good she might do there. The war might punish either choice with equal probability. The longer she thought about it, listening to the maid dusting on the landing, the more daunting any choice seemed. To begin life the first time had been a breeze. Being so newly fledged, one had only to step off the bow and be astonished by the sudden rush of air. Now, at 20, it was hard to begin again. One had to take off from the ground. Every wing beat had to be forced against an unsympathetic gravity. In the half-light from the courtyard, in the silence that lay on the white crocheted bedspread, she felt herself dissolving. Her father was away in his constituency. Her mother was spread thin with her coffees and committees, achieving a busy translucence. Some days Mary lay on the bed for hours. At first, with the funeral and boxing up Tom's things and writing to Alistair, she had crackled with a desperate energy. She had been certain that Alistair would reply. It had seemed to her that she would be fine again with just the slightest word to get her started in some direction. Now she cringed when she thought how foolish she had been to imagine that he might mind about her. And it wasn't only Alistair. Since receiving the manager's letter, she had written to Zachary directly at the Lyceum and received nothing in reply. Perhaps this was what it was to grow up. This realization that the world was already staffed with people and that one was not particularly needed. She lay on the bed and stared at the ceiling. The covings depicted an endless rope. At each corner, the rope described an inward whirl before embarking on the next cornice line. One could follow the rope all day. The telephone rang downstairs, and presently Palmer came up to call her to it. Nothing had changed in his tone. That he continued to treat her as if she was not greatly diminished, as if she required no particular sympathy, struck her as a colossal kindness. She followed him down the central stairway as a girl might follow a grown-up, in her bare feet on the soft runner, still wearing her nightgown at noon. The telephone was off the hook on the console table in the hallway. White narcissi overhung it, vased in crystal grey. It was Hilda.
"So, did you get yours? Your letter?"
"Yes," said Mary.
"And you're accepted too?"
"Yes." A squeal came down the line, as if a kitten had inhaled a kazoo.
"Oh, we'll have an adventure."
Mary leaned her head against the wood panelling. "I'm not sure."
"You haven't been thinking, have you? There's really no need. You see, there will be a peaked cap with a badge."
"You know I'm not a uniform girl."
"But it's hardly for your benefit, is it? It will work on men like catnip."
"I'm not in the market."
"Nonsense, darling. I telephoned the speaking clock. The time for mourning is over."
"But you are outrageous."
"Now, look here. If you were mourning, then I'd leave you to it. But now, you are just moping. You're almost certainly the reason Hitler is still bombing us. You know the Nazis cannot stand a funk."
"I just..."
"Stop it. Say you'll take the ambulance job. I've never worked a day in my life, and I'm hardly going to start without you."
Mary stared at the flowers, their trumpets screaming with pollen, the grey light surprised into colours by the vase. "I'm just not sure if..."
"Oh, do come along now,"
said Hilda in a plaintive voice.
"Won't you put down the handset, whoever you are, and fetch my friend Mary to the telephone?"
"I don't feel as if I'm for anything anymore. That's the trouble. I used to know straight away what was the right thing to do."
"Yes, but never mind, because that was infuriating."
"I'm sorry. I don't deserve you."
"The only thing you don't deserve is what's happened to you. Of course you feel low, but the longer you hide in your room, the worse it'll be."
"I just don't know if an ambulance job will help. It might only remind me."
"But don't you already think about it now?"
"Constantly."
"It will be the same then, only with uniforms and badges. Why wander through your thoughts when you could drive through them quite recklessly with sirens? The worst that could happen is that we might help someone."
Mary smiled despite herself.
"Us. Imagine."
"I know. Don't tell me you can't picture it. Screeching to the rescue. Oh, where did I put those bandages? I'm sure they were in this box, but it seems to be full of glamour."
Mary hesitated.
"I suppose we could try it for a while and see."
"That's the spirit. Or at least it's something to put your spirit in when we find it again."
Mary closed her eyes.
"Thank you."
And when no reply came, "Hilda?"
"It's just that you've never thanked me for anything before."
"See?" said Mary. "You should try being nice more often."
March 1941. At sunset, Mary reported to the air raid precautions station at St. Helen's Church in Bishopsgate. The church was undamaged, with only the windows boarded up. The area all around was laid waste, but Mary made a point of not looking. If one kept the great yellow mounds of smashed brick in the corner of one's eye, then the mind understood them as the contours of nature and forgot its trick of making one unhappy. A man wrapped in a grey blanket was sitting outside at a trestle table.
"I've come on church business," said Mary. "I'm the new vicar."
The man raised his eyes with what Mary felt was impressive weariness.
"Mary North," she said. "I'm to be the new driver for the joint war organisation stretcher party."
He looked her up and down. He was 50-ish and gaunt, with red eyes and a silver 2-day beard. He wore knee-high Wellingtons, and his jacket bloomed with water stains. His breath was vapour in the thin light of the sunset.
"You can drive?"
"Was it in the job description?"
At last the man smiled.
"I'm Hugh. I'm one end of the stretcher. Clive is the other. He'll be here once he runs out of beer money."
"Glad to know you," said Mary.
"You won't be. Have you done this work before?"
"It's my first time."
He angled a thumb over his shoulder.
"Well, the van's around the back if you want to familiarise yourself. There's no bells or whistles. It'd just be like a normal Sunday drive, only with bombing. The new nurse is already there. Keen little thing she is. Says she's been here since 2.
"That's my friend Hilda. Hates to miss a party. We signed up together."
"You wait years and then 2 come along at once."
The ambulance was a black Hillman saloon with red crosses on the door panels and 4 stretchers in a rack on the roof. Hilda was done up in a duffel coat 2 sizes too big for her. She was organising the medical bag, and when she looked up, her cap fell down over her eyes.
"Should we hug or salute?" she said. "Shall we do both, to be safe?"
Hilda's Red Cross brassard slipped to her elbow on the backswing.
"Idiot," said Mary. "Let me fix that for you." "Thanks. You'd think I might put it on properly, wouldn't you? I can bandage an arm recurrent, figure of 8 or spiral reverse, and I've a brand new certificate to prove it."
"It's always harder on oneself," said Mary, repinning the band.
"I hope they'll send us out with a proper nurse, just to start with."
"But you are a proper nurse. Look at you, with your hat and your armband. All you're missing is a fob watch."
"I've had 2 weeks' training. I took longer than that to learn to use a gas oven."
"Well, if we do pick up a casualty, I shall just have to drive us to the hospital quickly."
"Do you know if we actually have to wear the tin hats, by the way? Only mine makes me look like a mushroom. It's all right for you tall girls. You can carry it off."
"You know they become fashionable during the raids." Hilda tugged at her lower lip with her teeth.
"I suppose... But goodness, it's hard to make anything of this uniform.
I've tried it like this with skirt and stockings, and I've tried it with the trousers, which are just, ugh. I've been up since 5, you know.
Mary said, "You look fine." She had simply put on the skirt which they had issued her, cinched the belt around the jacket, and jammed a pack of Craven A's into each pocket. She lit one now.
"Oh," said Hilda, "are you cold? Let's sit in the van, shall we?"
Mary's hands were trembling. It was something they had done since the disaster. A bore, really. And it was sweet of Hilda to pretend it was only the cold. It was pleasant, in any case, to get into the Hillman. Mary settled in the driver's seat and cracked the window an inch to let the smoke out. The interior smelled nicely of laundry, which must have been the cargo until the van was requisitioned. In the passenger seat, Hilda checked her makeup in the mirror. She reapplied her lipstick, clicked the top back on, and said,
"Alistair still hasn't replied to me."
"I'm sorry," said Mary.
"It was a long shot. But I thought he might at least write back."
Mary found that she couldn't hold Hilda's eye. Hilda stared.
"You aren't writing to him as well, are you?"
"No," said Mary, electing to interpret Hilda's tense as the present simple.
"I suppose he's just a cad, then," said Hilda.
"I thought you liked him."
"Only if he likes me more. Those are the rules."
Mary nodded. "Sometimes you are almost Christ-like."
"You can say you were my first disciple."
"I'll say I did your hair." Hilda looked at her watch.
"I'm terrified, aren't you?
We wouldn't be doing this if it was really dangerous, would we?"
"You know what you should really worry about? It's that so many girls have volunteered, it won't seem exotic anymore."
"You suppose men won't care?"
"Goodness, no. Ambulance girls are 2 a penny.
"You ruin everything."
"Well, you can't have it both ways, can you? It's either a dangerous duty and dashing, or a breathtaking bore and banal."
"I liked it better when I was petrified."
"Then hush and let me work this van out. It's fine for you, Miss La-di-da, with your 2 weeks' training. All they gave me was my bus fare here."
Mary worked the pedals and moved the lever through the 3 gears in the box, plus reverse. The whole setup was far looser than her father's Austin Windsor. It would need to be sworn at quite robustly, but she felt it could just about be driven. Now that it was finally happening, now that the war had put her in uniform and issued her with a steering wheel and clutch, she felt more resignation than excitement. She supposed that there would be chaos now, and fire and furious noise, and yet it seemed much less of an adventure than her class had been. How her nerves had buzzed with it back then. Perhaps one died in slices, like a loaf.
"Do you suppose they'll give us tea?" said Hilda.
"They've told me nothing. You're the one who always knows things."
"Oh, that's just gossip," said Hilda. "No one tells me facts."
"Maybe they're worried you'd repeat them."
"Well, I wouldn't mind knowing something, even if I am only here to dish out aspirin and sticking plasters. The matron wouldn't trust me with anything, you know. She had me on bedpans half the time I was supposed to be training, so of course I never caught sight of a healthy man."
"Well, that is rather the point of nursing, isn't it?"
"But I wanted to go on the ward rounds with the junior doctors. The way the nurses get themselves up, the poor men don't stand a chance. They're married with 2 children and a Labrador before their pulse gets back below 100. I wonder if we're meant to write down any supplies we use, or whether someone comes and checks it at the end of the shift. I wonder if..."
Mary put her hand on Hilda's arm. "You'll be fine, you know." Hilda froze.
"Does it show so badly?"
"They wouldn't have passed you for duty if you weren't ready."
"I just can't stop thinking. What if I make a mistake? What if some poor so-and-so is hurt and I can't save them?"
"I thought you only cared about the uniform."
"Yes, but one is not entirely against human life. Oh, did I mention there's a party tomorrow morning at the hospital? All the girls on nights at St. Bart's, and as many of the doctors as can be dragged in, even if the nurses have to sedate and rope them. Apparently there's a boy from gynaecology who makes a very realistic martini using ethanol. He gets up a whole vat of the stuff, and they bring buckets of ice from the morgue, and someone turns up with a gramophone. You will come, won't you? And you won't bag the nicest man there just because you can."
"Not unless you see him first."
They laughed with the careful muting Londoners used now, knowing that the war homed in on the sound.
The raid began just before 5:30, and they went down into the crypt of the church, where the area post was set up. The stretcher man, Q, was already down there. The air raid precautions chief and his messenger were taking damage reports.
Two busy telephones and three full ashtrays stood on a carved communion table. On the wall was a pinboard map of 4 square miles. The bombs, when they got going, got closer.
"Jerry's on the money tonight,"
said Hugh. The ARP chief sniffed.
"I assume we are all aware that Jerry suckles from the breast until he is 6 years old?
"The men shave their armpit hair," said Hilda. "The women plait theirs."
Everyone winced as a bomb struck close by, resonating in the crypt.
"This is what comes of it, of course," said the ARP man. "They're up there now, at 20,000 feet, with fishnets under their flying suits."
Mary couldn't bring herself to join in. For her part, she found it hard to imagine that a race with so many peccadilloes could be annihilating her city quite so thoroughly. When the ARP chief sent them out into the night at 6:30, it was a relief. Every moment underground made Mary want to run. Outside, the noise was fearful. There was a Nakak gun right outside the church, a Bofors letting go dozens of rounds a minute. Red tracer streaked up into a smoky sky, impaled on the blue-white lances of the searchlights. Clive, the other stretcher-bearer, was snoring in the back seat of the ambulance. Hugh cursed him awake and pushed in beside him, while Hilda took the passenger seat and opened the A to Z. It was only 1/4 mile away, but the direct routes were blocked. Mary gunned the Hillman's little engine and made what speed she dared in the dark streets and the sudden drifts of smoke. Hilda braced herself against the glove box and used her cigarette lighter to read the map. In Gravel Lane, a house was down in the middle of the terrace. The front was blown out, and the upstairs floor had swung down on the pivot of the back wall. Another stretcher party was already leaving, with 2 casualties they had brought out of the mess. Hugh and Clive joined a rescue squad to clear the weight of the tiles and the roof joists, after which they would set up their A-frames to lift the collapsed floor. They waved Mary and Hilda away. All the two of them could do was wait. Mary put on her tin hat, lit a cigarette, and sat on the running board of the Hillman with her elbows on her knees and one hand on the back of her neck, trying to smooth out the jitters. A stick of bombs came down a few streets away, the flashes arriving before the bangs. The air was already sour with burning wood and spent explosive. Hilda took the medical bag from the boot.
"Find shelter," said Mary. "I'll fetch you if they bring anyone out."
"What about you?"
"I'll be fine."
"Then I'll be fine too, won't I?"
They sat together with their backs up against the van for whatever protection it gave. Without being asked, their bodies made themselves small.
Hilda said, "It feels wrong, being outside in a raid."
Mary offered her a sardonic look.
"I mean, it feels sort of naughty," said Hilda. "As if we're out of bounds."
They waited.
"Look at those searchlights," said Hilda. "I hope they'll keep them after the war. Just think, ordinary people don't get to see this. I wonder if..."
Mary looked to the sky. Perhaps it was true that the searchlights were beautiful. With the night chill and the endless deadening concussions of the Yakak, she felt flat. Hilda babbled on, her observations neither irritating nor illuminating. This was how Tom had talked in that awful raid. She wished now that she had known how to comfort him. How miserable Tom must have been close to the end. She had tried with a willing heart to love him, to smile as brightly as she ever had, but of course he had known that it was ending. He had been so thoroughly good about it, so careful not to make a scene. This was how a kind heart broke, after all. Inwards, making no shrapnel. Dear Tom. Without the war, they might have finished as friends. Now the rescue crew had their A-frames assembled to lift the collapsed upper floor. When they had made enough of a gap, a man crawled under. After a minute, he shouted out. Hugh and Clive ran to the van and lifted a stretcher off the roof.
"There's a man in there. They're going to bring him out."
Mary and Hilda ran across the road, Hilda carrying the medical bag. Hilda called out,
"Tell them not to move his head."
"Well, they're hardly going to leave it in there," said Clive.
They waited. The drone of bombers continued, and the blasts still came, seeming further away for the moment. The constant nasty crack of the 250-kilo bombs, and the occasional punch of a 1,000-kilo brute that shook the earth.
The man was brought out after a few minutes, on his back on a pine door that four men carried between them. They set him down in the road. One of the rescue men held up a battery lamp with a blackout shade, casting a slim cone of light. The casualty's eyes were open. Hilda knelt,